This is The Legal Lounge from Lanyon Bowdler Solicitors, where you'll hear about many aspects of law in England and Wales with special guests, industry experts, and local charities. Here's your host, Amanda Jones.
In this episode, Claire and Edward discuss the difference between mirror wills and mutually irrevocable wills. They strongly oppose the use of mutually irrevocable wills, as these are unable to be altered after the first person dies. Mirror wills allow for amendments and updates to reflect how people's lives can change, and there are easier and cheaper ways of achieving the same results.
Hello, I'm Edward, and I'm joined today again by Claire Vale.
Hi, Edward.
Nice to see you again, and great to have another chat about a private client-related topic of a contentious nature. So today's thorny discussion point is mirror wills versus mutual wills. So we better set the scene, and in so doing, explain what we mean by mirror wills and what we mean by mutual wills. I suppose that's that. If we don't do that, then some people who are tuning in are going to be mystified, yes, aren't they? If yes, you tune into a podcast, I don't know whether that's the correct term. We're talking, really, aren't we, about the scenario where, generally speaking, the wills of a husband and wife would generally, not always, but often, they would mirror one another. So classically, we'd have husband and wife doing their wills, and they would say, I'm paraphrasing, on the first death, I leave everything to the surviving spouse. And then on the second death, we divide everything between the children. So you're trying to create wills that will stand the test of time and either deal with that situation where husband dies very shortly after the wife, or they maybe die together in a car accident. Very, very rare event, but it does happen. That's mirror wills. They're mirroring the provisions of one another. And we deal with the creation of wills like that day in, day out. So mutual wills, or to give them their correct title, mutually irrevocable wills, would be like that, wouldn't they? But they'd be adding an extra massive fly into the very sticky ointment.
As you've sort of implied there, they are irrevocable, certainly after the death of the first of the two testators. They can be revoked on notice, you know, while they're still both alive. So if they change their minds, then they can serve notice on the other, and then they've both got the opportunity to, you know, change what they had done. But once the first testator has died, then the surviving testator's will cannot be altered at that stage. So they are sort of binding, they are irrevocable, they can't be altered at a later date, whereas obviously with a mirror will you can change them, and if you like, mutual wills go against what testamentary law is mainly about in this country, which is like freedom of whatever you want to do. If you want to leave everything to the cat's home or to the children or whatever, there is that freedom, and you can make as many wills as you like. You can change your mind as many times as you like. And in fact, you know, during the course of somebody's lifetime, their circumstances are likely to change. They might get divorced, they might get remarried, they might have more children. So mirror wills are the common wills that are done, usually between husband and wife. They have got that flexibility that mutual wills do not.
I'm going to cut to the chase. We do lots and lots of mirror wills for obvious reasons. Most people are either married, or they're in a registered civil partnership, or they have a partner. And most people, not everybody, but most people would probably choose either to leave everything to the survivor, or, you know, at least benefit the survivor in some way after the first of them has died. And so we're dealing with that kind of mirror will scenario day in, day out, and we think they're really good, and we like the idea of being able to change it, update it, upgrade it, cater for all kinds of eventualities, and actually have a review after the first death, because it's part of planning. It just makes sense. Mutual wills, or mutually irrevocable wills, I just think they're a really bad idea. I would say do not do mutually irrevocable wills. They're just really super knotty, super, super complicated, likely to be really, really expensive if you're doing it properly. Yeah, don't do it. I've never drafted one. because the people who
I don't know anyone
from,
who has.
Yeah, well, the people I learned from and trained with, it was, you know, absolutely no, you know, don't do this, don't get involved in it. It's just you're walking into a minefield. And then that's always been our line. And it's what we've always told the people that we're training up. And it's the way we've always worked.
Even at university, I was told you never do mutual wells. That was it. That was the end of the subject.
Well, yeah. All the practitioners that I speak to in other firms, you know, that it's same sort of thing. They wouldn't ever do them.
And the thing is, mirror wells do work extremely well, particularly where you've got a married couple who have got joint children. In other words, you know, it's perhaps it's their first and only marriage, and the children they've got are their, you know, their joint children. The complications, or where they might perhaps think about having a mutual will, would be where one or both of them has maybe been married before, or they've got children from a previous marriage or relationship. So what they're wanting to try and make sure is that after they've died, their spouse doesn't sort of do the dirty on them and change the will then to cut out the stepchildren and leave everything to their own children.
I'm not having a go at people for having a concern about this, and for the objective they have is that after they've both gone, they want
to protect their estate and make sure it goes to their chosen beneficiaries.
Yeah, absolutely. It might be the case that yes, they are they're the joint children from that marriage, and there's only been one marriage, but you know, you're a bit concerned about the survivor. What if they remarry and they forget to do a will? Or it might be that scenario where it's a second marriage and there's children from both marriages, and you want to make sure that the right thing is done by both.
There's a genuine concern there.
Absolutely. If you were looking at this from the outside and you didn't know too much about it, you might think, oh, well, yeah, we do want this mutual irrevocable thing because we don't want the survivor to be able to alter things. But our take on that is that this is a terrible way to try and achieve those objectives by using the mutually irrevocable wills setup. There are other better, easier ways to deal with that and to achieve your objective.
Yes, and you're talking there, I presume, about discretionary trusts, a life interest. To make sure that you're perhaps with the life interest, you know, in the matrimonial home, you can leave your interest in that in a trust so that your beneficiaries will benefit ultimately. And the discretionary trust is a bit wider than that, isn't it? You're putting in all the potential beneficiaries, if you like, and then it can all be sorted out after the second death, and you might have a letter of wishes as well to set out in that. Although it's not legally binding, it would set out what you would want to happen.
All of those things. Actually, the married couple, let's say, or the couple in the registered civil partnership, you know, who come to us and it, you know, they do have these two sets of children and they're wanted to protect the interests of both and see that the survivor is not left high and dry, because you're trying to balance all that out, aren't you? It would be the life interest trust that we would use. And we do quite a lot of those. I mean, we do quite a lot of those for other purposes as well. But it might be that people are interested in this as a side benefit. But that's a good way to protect the capital. So let's say the matrimonial home is the couple's chief asset. That's where, you know, the majority of the family wealth is. And so they want to protect that and see that the two sides of the family get their respective shares of the capital after the second death. Don't want to leave the survivor high and dry. You know, let's say it's a jointly owned matrimonial home. We sever the joint tenancy. If you want to know more about that, there's another podcast about that sort of thing that you can download. And then we have on the first death, instead of just leaving everything outright to the survivor, we leave a half share of the matrimonial home into a trust, and the terms of the trust are the survivor has a right to occupy it for the rest of their days. And then when they've gone, that share of the capital that belonged to the first drops down to their children, and that's a way to protect it and ring fence it and manage that ultimate distribution of the capital and ensure it goes where you want it to go.
Yes, because in my experience, life interests are probably not used as much as they could be, because I'm often consulted by children who are upset that, you know, mum or dad has died and they've left everything to their spouse. It's usually the children's or my client's step-parents, and they've trusted them, and they might have been together for quite a number of years, you know, married for a number of years, and they think, well, I can trust them if I leave my whole estate to them, including the house. I know that they'll do the decent thing later on. And unfortunately, you know, for whatever reason, they don't. After the first one's died, they go off and change their will and cut out the stepchildren, their stepchildren, and then my clients come along, they're very upset because they were expecting stepmum or dad to leave them at least half of the house or a share, and in fact they end up with nothing. So I think there's probably scope for more life interest trusts. Conversation then builds on, but you know, dad and stepmum had agreed, you know, that what would happen is that ultimately everything, you know, their combined estates was going to be divided between, you know, us and our step siblings. But that's not happened. And again, in my experience, the letter goes off to the step siblings and they say, get lost.
Yes, it's too
you know, and it's difficult, yeah. Really, yeah. You know, it's not always possible to do something about that, which is unfortunate when you think if they could have done perhaps a life interest in there, severed the joint tenancy if necessary.
Yeah, it's not altogether completely foolproof. It's not necessarily going to work 100% of the time if, for example, you sell the matrimonial home before the first death and buy a replacement one jointly as joint tenants, for example. Yes. So take advice, review your will, and take advice before you buy that replacement property jointly. And actually, a lot of this would turn on who you've appointed as your executors and trustees, and who are you left with as the trustees at the time of the second death. It's not completely 100% foolproof, but I think if you compare it with the other approach, which might be to reach for the mutually irrevocable will, I'd say it's a lot safer than that. And that, I think, is, you know, has a whole load of gaping mine shafts that you could fall into. So, you know, let's say you had the husband and wife who said, well, we want to be sure that the survivor will do the right thing and it will all end up with, you know, with the respective children. They will all get their fair share. So let's make it mutually irrevocable. And the scenarios that you've talked about, or, you know, that where they've come to say, well, they meant to do that. So then you've got ambiguity, haven't you? Because unless it actually says on the face of the will, these are not mutually irrevocable wills, how can you be sure? But let's say you did set things up so that they were mutually irrevocable. What happens at the time of the second death if, by the time you work out that the wills were meant to be mutually irrevocable, and actually there's evidence that they were mutually irrevocable, but by that stage the property's gone and the money's gone, what are you going to do then? So I think there's, like I say, it's not absolutely completely 100% foolproof using the trust, but there's a lot more protection and a lot simpler than the mutually irrevocable wills. Not a fan of them at all.
I haven't had any cases on mutual wills, mm-hmm. per se. The scenario that I encounter quite mm-hmm. frequently mm-hmm. is where you have an adult child yeah. will come in, yeah. And say, you know, stepmum or dad has died, yeah. and I've just found out that the whole estate, including money or property that my own parent had, you know, that belonged to them, that had passed to my step parent, that's all gone now to mm. my over to my step siblings, mm. and I've got nothing, even mm. though, you know, it was the understanding, the agreement, if you like, mm. that ultimately mm. their combined estates on the second death would be divided equally, yeah. between me and my siblings and the step siblings, yeah. as well. Yeah. And then I'm asked to advise, you know, well, what can we do? Is there anything that we can do about this? Mm. And often the answer is no, yeah. unfortunately.
In that scenario, if you were the stepchild on the second death, that 1975 Inheritance Act, you wouldn't have a right to bring a claim, would you? Even go down that route, or have I got that wrong?
In that situation where I, you know, maybe I'm acting for, you know, the children of the first one to die, I am sort of having to fall back on looking at, is there a 1975 Act claim? Mm-hmm. And often there isn't, because although they're eligible to bring a claim as a child of the deceased or even a child of the family in relation to the step parents, they've still got to go through all the Section 3 factors under the Act. They've got to show that they are in financial need. And so if they're comfortable, they've got their own property, they work, there's nothing wrong with them, they may not have a claim under the 75 Act. So then you're thrown back onto a moral obligation, writing to the step siblings and saying, well, look, this isn't what the parents had agreed or intended. It's not fair. You know, if the deaths had taken place the other way round, you could be in this situation.
Yes, it's a lottery, isn't it?
Aren't you prepared to do the decent thing and share the estate?
Yeah.
And in my experience, the answer is usually no.
Sad to hear, but not unexpected, perhaps.
It's a situation that I think could be avoided if the wills perhaps were dealt with in a different way, rather than just leaving everything outright to the surviving spouse and trusting that they're going to do the decent thing.
Well, it's certainly something that we cover off with clients, and it's something that actually, you know, most of them have thought about this before they'd come to you, and they say, well, what, you know, what's the way that we deal with this? What's the best way to deal with it? So you have a discussion about, well, a trust is actually the best way to deal with this. And the life interest trust, it's a trust. You can't pretend it's not more complicated than not having a trust. But it's kind of, from a tax perspective, if surviving spouses are involved, it's kind of it's as tax neutral as a trust can be. So it's as low maintenance as a trust can be in this day and age. Discretionary trusts, which, again, we love, and you talked about letters of wishes, there's nothing we like doing more than fine-honing a well-crafted letter of wishes to accompany a discretionary trust. But there's a bit more to that kind of arrangement. From a taxation regime perspective, I mean, it depends on the size of the trust fund. Day in, day out, we are doing a lot of the capital protection through that life interest trust where you're dealing with spouses or registered civil partners. But we're never going to do a mutually irrevocable will, because I mean, actually, it would be a massive rigmarole if you had a couple where they were really insisting on doing it. You know, what are you going to do? You couldn't really act for both sides of, you know, the couple doing these mutually irrevocable wills, for the same reasons I think that you wouldn't if you're doing a prenuptial agreement or even a postnuptial agreement for a married couple. You can't act for both sides in that. I mean, for, I think, fairly obvious reasons that we probably, you know, we don't need to go into. So it'd be the same sort of scenario, wouldn't it? Because you're entering into an agreement. It's a contractual agreement to not break the will, isn't it? So really, you've got to be separately advised. So it's a big enough rigmarole just doing the wills without then having to add this extra layer of, well, sorry, Mr. and Mrs. Bloggs, but, you know, we can act for you, Mr. or Mrs., but you, the other half, I think, if you're really insisting on doing this in this parallel universe where we might perhaps consider doing it, you, the other one, are going to have to go off and be separately advised by another independent solicitor before this is all completed. And it's all going to have to mirror and sync up, but we can't, we shouldn't act for both of you, I don't think, in this arrangement. So they're going to say, well, how much is it going to cost? Is it going to double the cost? Well, I think at least, isn't it? You know, at least it's going to be horrendously expensive, which should be enough to put most people off. I absolutely completely get the objective, but don't approach it through the mutually irrevocable will, whatever you do. There we go. All right. If that wasn't clear enough, I don't know what is.
Thanks to Edward and Claire for sharing their expertise, yet more proof that lawyers don't bite. If you found the conversation useful, please remember to follow or subscribe on your app so you're notified of new releases when they come out every Monday. Speak to you next week.
That was The Legal Lounge from Lanyon Bowdler Solicitors. Visit lblaw.co.uk/podcast for helpful resources, and please do follow or subscribe on your podcast app so you never miss an episode.